So in companies, they keep it so tightly confined that no one knows and can learn from the scenario. So managers will consistently say, we don't have a problem at this workplace. And look, I used to know that in my old work life. And I used to say, no, you do. I've settled 5 cases for you. The complete shutdown means no one ever knows they've ever had a case.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. Well, this week, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, is back in the studio. Now, if you're a regular listener, a subscriber, if you tune in every week, you will know that I spoke to Kate, I think a couple of months ago now, just at the time where she launched a new national workplace inquiry into sexual harassment. She's spearheading this process as the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. In that conversation we had a little while back, she sort of talked in broad terms about some research that the Human Rights Commission had produced on the scale of the problem, and she outlined her approach to the inquiry, which was then coming up. I said at the time we'd bring her back because I'm fascinated really by this inquiry, which is so topical for obvious reasons, where it'll go, where it'll land, what people are saying, what, if any, proposals she comes up with at the end to change the system. So this is just a touch-base conversation now that several hearings have been underway around the country. Kate and I are going to basically pull apart what's happened since the last time we spoke. Listen up. Kate Jenkins, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
I'm so delighted to have you back because regular listeners will know that, a couple of months ago we had a chat.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. About your national inquiry into sexual harassment. And I mentioned during that conversation I would get you back and we would see how that conversation's playing out. So you've been out and about. I see all of the adverts for forums for people to come along and talk to you and all of that sort of stuff. Where are you up to and what are you hearing?
Yeah, so when I was here last time, we just launched the national results of our survey. And so that told us the stats. And the headline stat was 1 in 3 people in the workplace in the last 5 years said they'd been sexually harassed. And there was a heap behind that. So the conversations since then have been consultations around the country. So I've covered actually an awful lot of the country. I've been to Geraldton and Perth and Darwin, as well as Hobart, Adelaide, here in Canberra. I'm at the moment spending time in Melbourne. So I'm making sure I go everywhere.
And just a sec, roll back just a sec. So who's showing up to these things? Who's coming along?
Yeah, it's a real interesting mix, and I will do a pitch for We'd Like More Men. Who's showing up? So we're doing some public consultations, and that's a real mix of people. At most of them, I get one or two people who've had a pretty devastating, like life-changing experience of sexual harassment. But I also get just people who work in places, and they're just interested, men and women. We're doing employer-focused sessions. We're doing policy sort of union focused sessions. And then to make sure we hear different voices, we're doing some specific ones. So in Melbourne, we are going to do one that focuses on culturally and linguistically diverse people, some LGBTI workers. We're also looking at young workers in the hospitality and retail industry. We've done some on women in male-dominated industries like mining. So some of them are quite specific on how it works in a particular location or industry, and some are really looking for general insight.
Right. Okay. So anyway, you've been all around the countryside, Geraldton and Hobart and all these places. Are the stories different regionally or are they all depressingly the same? Or
Both. I think both. Like in every location, there is definitely some location-based messages that we get. But as I think back, there's a couple of key themes. One of them is sexual harassment happens everywhere. So even everyone thinks their industry might be the one, but public service has it, hospitals have it, mine sites have it. You know, it happens everywhere. So that's been pretty consistent. also consistent has been just a desire that, or really clarity on why people don't want to complain. So even though it's different everywhere, in almost every location, people have said, this is a small town or this is a small industry or if I complain. So in Hobart, they said, this is a small town. In Adelaide, they said, this is a small town. In Geraldton, which I think is a smaller town, they said that. But actually, in all the major cities as well, there's this sense in Australia of we're pretty close-knit. Everyone knows everyone. In Canberra, exactly the same story. And so the reasons why people don't want to complain is, one, is they can't afford to lose their jobs. So that's really the starting point. So whether they're a casual worker at a restaurant or whether they're an executive in a hospital, they're saying, we can't afford to lose our jobs and we think raising this will make us the enemy. And we also don't think anything will happen. So the message is really clear. We actually don't want to complain and we need to improve that. But I also think the message is, why do we have to complain? Like, employers should be taking steps. They should be making sure that this isn't everyday work. I've heard some stories on mine sites where women say, we stand out as it is anyway. There's only a few of us. And if we complain, it'll just be a disaster for us. So we actually have to be more blokey than the blokes. We have to fit in. But every day I hear stuff that is offensive, belittling, you know, kind of. So they're saying, look, but if I have to complain, it's going to put me at risk, both my career, but also my safety. But the employers should be able to start doing things even without waiting for me to complain.
You're suggesting the obvious way through there, which is that obviously don't wait for the complaint if you're the employer. If you're their employer and you're witnessing conduct in your own workplace that's suboptimal, perhaps just do something about it rather than waiting for someone to complain. But when you embarked on this inquiry, you were sort of embarking on it in a structural sense. You were looking at your piece of legislation and looking whether or not it could be changed in order to deliver better results, right? So as someone with that mindset going into this inquiry, which I hope I've represented you correctly, that was your mindset. So then how does it become easier for people on the receiving end of poor conduct to make a complaint? Is there something that you can do to make it easier for them in order to come forward?
And remembering I'm only halfway through the consultations or a little bit further, I think the reality is the National Inquiry have got quite broad terms of reference. So whilst I will look at the legal framework, I'm also looking at what employers should do and I'm looking more broadly. So I would say, and this is really early, so don't hold me to it and don't look at the report next year and say she hasn't done that because I might change my mind. But the messages I'm hearing is that there's something broader about the culture across the board as well as in workplaces, and that if we can start, we're starting to get into that with family violence. The ads that are out there at the moment that stop it at the start, ads which show a father, you know, sort of making light of a boy,
they're quite powerful,
flipping a girl's. So those ads have come up consistently, and there is a real view that there's a connection between respect for women, gender equality, women in senior roles, and whether this happens. So that's a broad sort of community message for me and a workplace message. Then the next part I think is workplaces need to do some things differently, and what that is I'm not settled on yet. And lastly, in terms of the legal framework, it is really where culture fails, that people go to the legal framework. I've had interesting conversations about how the Human Rights Commission, for example, does handle complaints really well, but not many people come to us. I've heard that workplace disputes often go to Fair Work, and that there are some good things about that and some bad things, as in they're fast and people want fast, but they're perhaps not sensitive on a complex issue. And then I've heard of lots of people, especially out in WA and in Northern Territory, say, look, we get safety. We talk safety all the time. We have toolbox talks every week about safety. Could you use that system, and could the regulatory system there be similar for sexual harassment? So And that goes to the silence on sexual harassment. They say, if there's an accident at a site, by the next Monday, most mine sites will have a toolbox talk and you'll know what happened in a general sense, what needs to change and what to do better. If there's a sexual harassment issue, most of them say, we never hear about it. We get it in induction and, you know, great news, day one, if you're sexually harassed, here's how you complain, which no one thinks will ever happen to them. And maybe you get a refresher every year or so. But there's nothing that tells you that the workplace thinks this is a real problem. So could we make
Build it in?
Yeah, could we make it just a normal conversation that I think people have viewed that this isn't a big issue. We now know it is. So let's just start talking about it.
Interesting. So have you had, in terms of the tone and tenor in these forums that you've had, like I'll share a little recent experience with you. I was on a panel, moderating a panel for the National Farmers Federation and at their annual congress, and that was all about diversity and different points of view, and I was on a panel with an ANU expert who's looked at sexual harassment in the bush. And so it was quite a, well, I won't say confronting panel, that's a bit florid, but it was fairly straight talking, the panel. And, you know, people reflected their own experience in rural industries, and the ANU expert reflected what the research said. And the first question from the floor was in the genre of what I'll call not all men, right? You always get that whenever you talk about these issues, right? And obviously I'm not criticising the woman who opened the batting with not all men, because, well, look, fair enough. But this long-winded anecdote is me saying people are still uncomfortable about talking about this, and some women, strangely, are uncomfortable and feel this need to inoculate themselves or their loved ones or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So what have you found? Have you had the not all men question come at you?
Oh, yes. The not all men comes up a lot. And I've actually done a tiny little social media thing saying, come on, men, come and talk to me, because actually all men need to be in this conversation. Because what we know is actually our research, that 1 in 3 was made up of 39% women but 26% men. So first and foremost, we know men are victims, most frequently from other men. So just to be clear, it's a power thing. We know that they are 4 out of 5 perpetrators, so might be not all, but of the perpetrators, a lot of them are men. And men are often leaders, so they're bystanders. So if I go back to those male-dominated industries, I've heard it a number of times women saying what was devastating was my male friends, so there's a woman, Sparky, who's the only woman in the site, it was devastating because no one did anything. So I actually felt much more vulnerable, not just then, but going forward, because I realised no one was going to stand up for me. So the not all men conversation, to me, it's like no one said it's all men, but I absolutely think the solution needs to be informed by how men are seeing this problem. But to recognise that when men have come, some of them are really, like, it's eye-opening. If you've never experienced sexual harassment, to hear what it's like to have that everyday belittling experience. And I've seen men just sort of leave going, I was going to contribute, but holy cow, I did not realise. So some of it is that education and engagement of men. I think we're getting that, whether it's for good or bad reasons. I'm talking to a lot more senior men who are saying, I didn't realise, but now I do, I need to do something.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I believe we're at a turning point. I think, you know, the news cycle is telling us stories every day. There's lots of splinters to the stories, but it's actually bringing to light those things that have been really hidden. That's the other thing that I was, wanted to mention was I'm talking to employers and now asking them to let people who've entered confidential settlements contribute to the inquiry. So that silence, there's pros and cons of that. You know, often, as we've seen in some of the media, people who have complaints don't want to be talking about their sexual harassment experiences over and over. But we need to learn from how the complaints worked, how the settlements were reached, to understand whether the system's working well or where we need to change it.
And it's sort of not only, is it, it's not only people, although we can think about this in a sec, you know, women who have been outed, in essence, in these some of these cases, you know, women who have clearly not wanted actually to be the centre of a national news story, but
yes,
have found themselves, yes, whoa, surprise, here, yeah, I am at the centre, yeah, of a national news story. So there's that. But there's also, I suppose, just practically when you think about non-disclosure, like I totally get why you'd want to open that up, because then you get some case studies into the public domain that otherwise would not be there and remove this culture of silence around it. But then is there potentially, you know, put your lawyer's hat on, I suppose. Like, is there a problem? Does that signal to the marketplace, oh, look, well, we've settled this matter, we've gone through a process, we've settled this matter to the satisfaction of both parties, but then it can be subsequently re-litigated in the court of public opinion or wherever that is. Does it have a chill effect, potentially, I suppose, on settlements? So there's sort of two sides of the same coin, right? There's the people who don't want to be identified and, whoops, here I am, I'm identified.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then also people who do have a process, you know, unfortunately, that works for them, in inverted commas, get a legal settlement, whatever that is, then it gets opened up again. How do you sort of run those fault lines? Brackets, good luck.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's part of the reason why we want to talk to people, not because I have an endpoint view. My gut says, because I was one of the lawyers who reached those settlements.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Don't think I ever did a settlement that didn't have a confidentiality clause in it. So I'm not saying they're good, bad or indifferent, but they have been common practice. And I think there's reasons why both employers and employees might want them. And I'm not, I'm really keen to know how that works. My gut says there's a couple of things about the confidentiality that we could just be a bit more creative. So managers will consistently say, we don't have a problem at this workplace. And look, I used to know that in my old work life. And I used to say, no, you do. I've settled 5 cases for you. Like you, but so how, you know, the complete shutdown means no one ever knows they've ever had a case.
Even in the firm, even in the firm in which this case has occurred, they don't know.
So in companies, that's right. So they keep it so tightly confined that no one knows and can learn from the scenario. So my sense is that that there is absolutely reasons why individuals would not want anyone to be discussing their names on all sides, respondents, complainants. So the question is, okay, but that doesn't, you know, what that's led to is a complete silence. And for an employer, you know, what are you reporting to the board? You could report in a de-identified way that we had 3 cases, that they involve this type of conduct. So I'm being quite creative about what we might want, but I haven't drawn a conclusion on non-disclosure agreements, because I can absolutely see the benefits, and I can also see the real risks of having this court of public opinion. That really was right at the start of this. The Minister O'Dwyer was really, like, you know, watching things unfold and saying, you know, is it helpful that every day we're learning one new piece of information about each of these people, when in fact, wouldn't we be better to wait to the end and just know what the process told, you know, in terms of who was right or wrong? And I do tend to agree with that. So I am going to do, and I will invite you to it, in fact, a targeted consultation to talk to media outlets, because I know from lots of, there's lots of journalists who are writing about the pros and cons of speaking, but there's also lots of editors in the media who say, it's really hard. When do we report? When do we not? What's our role in this? So I am interested. I think that's a current conversation given the 24-hour news cycle and the world we're in.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, like, well, it's highly pertinent in terms of the 24-hour news cycle, because that's part of the reason why now these cases are consumed iteratively, hour by hour.
Yes.
You know, literally the morning session and
That's
the afternoon
right.
session, and then an overnight wrap. You know, whereas 10 years ago, you might have got the overnight rap or, or, right? So it's sort of like, I don't know how you shut that gate. I'm fascinated about you thinking about how you can. But how you shut that gate is very complex. But I totally agree with you. And, you know, I've reflected on these issues, right? Like I totally agree with you that perhaps it's better that the gate gets shut more regularly than it does.
So this is where, you know, if anyone's listening, they'll go, Kate, make up your mind. But I've got another 6 months at least to make up my mind. But there's pros and cons about shutting the gate or keeping it open, because in my professional career, you know, there's laws in place, but over time it became clear that a well-funded employer could handle the laws and the legal process. So actually it was a reputational risk that motivated them to really take these issues seriously. So I've over my career said, you know, in my experience, when employers do something well, it's usually because of scandal or leadership. But actually, it was mostly because of scandal or leadership, because they knew there was a scandal in prospect. So you know that the media's had a positive role where people haven't been able to get anywhere to just push the, you know, conversation along. Yeah. So that's the, you know, those are the things I'm juggling. And I'm not settled on where we should end up, but I know that in the UK and the US, they've looked particularly at non-disclosure agreements. And in both cases, they've come up with a regulation arrangement that says generally no unless the employee asks for them. So there's a couple of models that are floating around that'll be good to have a look at. But I'm not clear on where I'm going to end on that.
Well, you know, I don't know how you'll get clear. Honestly, I mean, that's obviously it's your job. Obviously, it's your job,
this
love.
This is all I'm doing.
No. Obviously, and I don't doubt your you know, mental capacity to get the clarity. It's just that there are so many sort of the laws of unintended consequences all the way through this, right? You sort of fix one problem, create another one, all of that sort of stuff. But look, at the end of the day, though, transparency is better than not, right? Just as a principle.
Look, I think so. I mean, I go to that. It's my job. I think to some degree the laws came in 84. I think we thought doing policies, procedures and training would fix it. I think that actually this is the first time anyone stopped to look deeply at all of the ways those unintended consequences have unfolded. And so I'm really confident that actually we can move from what we've been doing, and there will be a new solution and a new path forward. And I think the appetite is there right now. So I'm not, I'm confident the answer is there. And I'm doing the consultations. We've got the survey, but the other thing I'm doing is submissions. So if anyone's listening to this with just a view on one of the things we're talking about, you can just send us an email at the National Inquiry. So you just Google Sexual Harassment National Inquiry, you'll find us. Because it's every day those ideas, those experiences that are helping, and I'm listening to this every day, that are slowly emerging into answers. So I'm confident we will come up with something new and not just keep talking and complaining about it.
Yeah, well, that's great. And everybody did hear that message from Kate, right? If you do have an experience that is valid and relevant to this inquiry and you've got some thoughts that might be helpful, you can hear through these couple of conversations, we've got some really big weighty issues here in play. Add your voice. If you want this to change, add your voice. Speak up. You know, participate in the inquiry. It's really important that you do that, so that the landing point, you know, it takes us to a better place than where we are now.
Fantastic. Thank you. I completely endorse that statement. That's absolutely really what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, good. Okay. No, well, we'll leave it there for now, but I will bring you back again as we're sort of heading towards the landing point, or perhaps when the buses landed at the station, or do buses land?
Planes land, but that's all right.
Plane, bus, whatever it is. I shouldn't mix my vehicle metaphors. Anyway, we'll have another conversation before this is out. And remember what we've said about participating. But for now, Kate, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Well, thank you very much for tuning in. As always, we really do appreciate it. Thank you to Miles and to Hannah for sterling services to production, as always. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thank you in advance for subscribing and sharing. You know the drill. In the event you like the series, do subscribe, do share, do tell your friends about it. It is very important that that happens. Now, we're heading next week and the week after into the final two sitting weeks for parliamentary sitting weeks before we sort of stagger in the direction of the summer holidays. That'll be brisk and brutal, as it always is. And there is really so much more, actually, between now and Christmas in policy terms. We've got the Labor conference. We've got a number of key government policy decisions between now and Christmas. It's going to be hectic. I hope you'll strap in with me from now until the end. We'll be back next week.